The views and opinions expressed by the guests on the following program do not necessarily represent those of Mark Radio, The Shepherd, or its advertisers.
From the studios of the Shepherd Radio Network, it's Afternoons with Mike. This next hour is all about our walk with Jesus, with local pastors, newsmakers, people who are making a difference for the gospel. Now, here is your host, Mike Gilland.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the program today. I have with me in the studio here at our Shepherd Studios, John Heaver. Pastor John Heaver from H2O Church. John is an author. John has studied and received a degree from RTS, that's Reformed Theological Seminary, right in Orlando, right?
That's right.
And it's great to have you here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. A little nervous, but that's okay.
Oh, don't be nervous. We're going to have way too much fun to be nervous.
I'm ready for that.
It would not work. You know, what do you like to be called? Do you like John or do you like Pastor John? How do you go by? How do your people in your church
They call me John. There's a small minority that can't do that, and they have to call me Pastor John. But everyone else, and sometimes some people ask, like, what should we call you? Just call me John. That's my name.
Yeah. What drew you to this area? Were you always from Florida?
I was born and raised in Florida, but we moved to Ohio when I was in the fifth grade. And I think I realized at some point that I hate cold weather.
Now, I know you spent time in Muncie. Is that where you went to college?
No. I went to The Ohio State University, and yes, I did have to say The.
The Ohio State University, right.
I went over to Bowling Green and got my degree in physical therapy from the Medical College of Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my schooling, and I didn't do theological training at RTS until much later in my life.
Now, what drew you to Muncie, Indiana? What was that all about?
So, in my junior year of college, some buddies of mine said, we would like you to join us. We're going to do a church plant in Bowling Green. And I said, you don't understand. I just got accepted into the PT program here. And they said, we want you to come. So I dropped out of college and moved to Bowling Green and got involved in that church plant. And that was so exciting. So when I graduated and...
Now, was it actually being called a church plant in that time?
That must
be right after that terminology is relatively, in the last 20 years, 30 years maybe. But I know when we came down here to be part, it was still being called pioneering a church.
I don't know what we call it. I knew is it was very exciting. And so when I graduated, what was in my heart was I want to see God show up in my life and I want to do something new. And so I went to Muncie because I'd been there one time and I just wanted to start a church from scratch. And so that's what we did.
So you started a brand new work in Muncie, Indiana. Now, for those that are not familiar with Muncie, that would be central-ish, kind of north of Central, I guess.
Yeah.
Northwest of Indianapolis?
It's actually more northeast.
Oh, see, I had
it.
Yeah. Yeah, for whatever. Yeah, that's right. Northeast of Indiana. I'll get that straight. Of Indianapolis. And it is, it's the home of Ball State. And people may have heard of Muncie or Ball State because of David Letterman. On his show, he was always talking and making fun, actually, of where he went to college.
That's our claim to fame.
Yeah.
That's about it.
I can't imagine what that'd be like to be on the receiving end up there. But I know it's a lovely area. And it is what I would consider to be a typical representation. Indiana people are wonderfully friendly.
They are.
And, when you get down a little bit more south, down toward where I was from, you have a lot more cornfields and all of that. But there's still, I know you would have had plenty of them up there too.
Yeah. It was a very exciting time for me because.
What year would that have been?
Let's see, that was 1987. Yes, 1987. And it was exciting because my heart has always, I wasn't brought up in a Christian family. I didn't learn about Jesus until I was 17. And so my heart has always been to reach out to people that are spiritually curious. So when we started the church at Ball State, we wanted it to feel very unchurchy. So we called it the Revolution, which I don't know if that is a great name or not, but it was exciting for me because when we asked anyone in our congregation to stand up if they had come to know the Lord through our ministry, half the church stood up. And I don't know. That's just the way I've always had that heart to reach out to
people. That would not be a typical name back then for a church at all.
No.
And so, you know, that begs the question, a revolution, what are you resolving to fight against? What is this revolution? What kind of change are we talking? Well, then when you start using the word change, that's very biblical.
Yeah. And I think the bottom line thought of that is that if you really come to know Jesus and you understand what his heart is and what he's about, it will cause a revolution in your life.
Yeah.
And that's what we were about.
You coined that and it worked.
Yeah, it worked. It worked great.
Well, go back before that a little bit. How did you first come to know the Lord?
Mm. So there was this girl.
Uh-oh.
How many stories start like that, right?
Uh-oh.
I was a big partier, and I knew that something was wrong. I remember walking into a party one time and seeing everyone drinking, and that's what I always did. And I just left the party because I was so angry. Like, I knew that there had to be more to life, but I had no idea what it was. So there was this girl that was involved in Young Life, and I started to go to Young Life, and they talk about Jesus, mm-hmm. and it was fun. So I didn't mind any of the talk about Jesus. I got invited to a camp, Frontier Ranch in Colorado, and there at the camp, they had a former gang member from New York City who was giving talks about God each night. And the night before I became a believer, they talked about sin. I had never heard anything about being separated from God by your sin. And I walked out of that meeting just angry at God. It's like, I want to know you, but I can't. Thanks. And then the next night they shared the cross and mm-hmm. everything fell into place. And it's like a veil was taken off my eyes and like, I'm all in.
It's so crazy, isn't it, to realize the impact of the gospel on a heart that thinks there's no hope or a life that feels like it's too late.
Yeah.
It's never too late.
If I hadn't come to know Jesus, and this is probably just something about my personality, might have committed suicide, definitely would be an alcoholic, and I am positive I would be divorced.
Mm-hmm.
So Jesus moving into my life made changes that changed my perspectives about everything. And it really gave me hope more than anything, because I'm very philosophical and deep thinking. And without Jesus, like what purpose is there? I had to find that.
Now, why would you say that about the suicide? Because the other part I get and I understand, but that is such a radical departure for many, many people. When they hear that, it's so shocking, in your face kind of rejection of the life that we've been given. What were you exposed to people who committed suicide?
My wife has a family member who committed suicide. And I think both my wife and I have streaks of depression in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so we grasp how people can feel hopeless. We're aware of how a person can be driven to commit suicide. I went on 3 mission trips to Africa, and the happiest guy that I knew in the world was there in Kenya, and we became friends.
Isn't that something? This is a real theme for me, because I've had a lot of talks with both missionaries and people who lead missionary organizations. And this theme about going on a trip and thinking you're going to be there to minister and bring the joy of the Lord to them. And you get there and you find out, wait a minute, it's already here.
Right. That is so true, especially in Kenya. That was exactly my experience.
In fact, they're more joyful than I am.
Absolutely.
I'm going back changed. I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the simplicity of their lives is a part of that. But on my second trip, I got over there, and my friend Mark was the happiest guy I knew. And on the first day that we got there, they told me that he had committed suicide.
Oh.
And he was the last person I would have thought. And so what that communicated to me is that so many of us have a story underneath our lives, a subtext that we're not willing to be vulnerable about. And so as I've followed Jesus, I've tried to live from the heart and tried to minister to people's hearts, knowing that that there's deep stuff going on mm-hmm. in all of us, especially in this last year. There's so much hopelessness, I think, in so many people. Yeah. And I think people can feel like God has ghosted us, which is not reality, but we can feel that way.
You know, you bring up such a good point about the response of a lot of people, because number one, there's two things going wrong. There are the things that are, let's say, really out there right now, like COVID and all of the economic stuff that's happening. And then you've got the fear about what's happening in the border and yeah. all of the unknowns that Americans, but then there's this other thing, a lack of knowledge about God in general.
Yeah.
And when you put those two things yeah. together, those can be kind of overwhelming to people.
Well, we're becoming more and more biblically illiterate.
Yeah.
You know, we have to, you can't be deeply changed by that which you do not know. And so for me, that was something that I learned early on is I've got to know this book. I've got to know this God. I've got to walk with this God. And really, hope needs to become real mm-hmm. in me.
So you have this message that comes to you there, and the cross is presented, and
yeah.
it impacts your life, changes you. Did you have any idea early on in that change that one day you'd be doing what you're doing?
I think the first time that I heard, I remember hearing a teaching. Let me backtrack. I want to go on a quick tangent in that. When I came home from Colorado, I talked to my brother and asked him for forgiveness because I had not been a real great brother to him. And after he forgave me, I said, can I just tell you about Jesus? And he accepted the Lord right then.
Oh, wow.
My mom may have been a believer already, but about 2 years later, after many conversations, she said, let me get this right. Salvation is by grace alone. But after you come to know the Lord, then you want to do works mm-hmm. spontaneously. It's like, yes. And from that point, she began to change. My sister came to know the Lord later, and my dad went to a Young Life camp where they said, we want to share with you what we've shared with your kids. And so my dad accepted the Lord. So I share that only that I think the mark of what I would become was there right from the start to tell people about Jesus. But the first time I heard a teaching about the call to become a pastor, I just realized I'm all in. Let's go. Mm-hmm. Let's go. Let's do that.
That's really exciting to see a receptivity to the gospel like that. You know, sometimes, I mean, there's a lot of people like myself. I fought it. Mm. I didn't want it. I don't know if it was because of what I'd seen and what I had observed, but I just didn't think that I could do it
yeah.
and wanted to do it. And I was very happy. I had found radio already, and back in that day, radio and Christian TV was coming around, and I thought, well, this is a way to take the gospel. It made sense to me that we could see the gospel go out on the airwaves and through television programs, and I could that wasn't God's will for my life, and it took a real radical thing. Mm. But I just love it when I hear a story like, first time I heard it, I'm all in. I think that's wonderful.
Well, I think God worked in my life to break me. Baseball was a big thing for me, and my goal in my junior year of high school was to lead the league in hitting.
And what league are we talking about?
Oh, just our high school league. You know,
okay, you played high school ball.
Yeah, and... Okay. So that didn't exactly happen. I had the worst baseball slump ever known to man. I went 1-47.
Okay, that's getting down there. Yeah,
you could close your eyes, have your hands tied behind your back, and do better than that. And so 1 week later is when I went to the camp in Colorado. And so I was at a very broken state, knowing that alcohol wasn't going to satisfy me, and knowing that my selfish ambition, this drive to be something, wasn't going to do it either. And mm-hmm. I think that just prepared my heart to hear about Jesus.
That's wonderful. You know, the Lord uses all these really crazy things in our lives, yeah. and sometimes it's failures, sometimes it's batting slumps. 1-47, that's, I do the math, and you're not going to get any accolades for that one, that's for sure. But Boy, it's great to come to the Lord, however we get there. That's really neat. And you've spent time now in both Indiana and in Florida. Well, I don't have to guess which of the two you like the best, right?
Yeah, I wasn't thinking about how cold it was when I lived up there. Mm-hmm. But once I came down here, it's like, how did I survive?
Yeah.
The Midwest winters are terrible. So, yeah, I'm all about Florida now.
Yeah, Cindy and I moved here in 85, and we laughed at all the Floridians at wintertime. We would see them freeze, and we're thinking, you call this cold? And then the second winter, we were freezing too because your blood turns to orange juice. That's just what happens, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you get used to it, and now I no longer make fun of anybody who's cold because I get cold.
That was exactly my experience.
Yeah.
You know, when we moved down here, I would just laugh at people. Like, they'd put on a fur parka when it dropped to 70. We had one of our kids, we asked about recess, and she said, well, we didn't have recess today because it was too cold. And it was like 60 degrees. It's like, what are you talking about? What planet is this?
Yeah, the 60 degrees when you're from Indiana and you come down to Daytona Beach, you go swimming.
Exactly.
I mean, that's exactly what you do. I mean, you're happy about it.
Right.
You're going to brag about it to all your friends up north? Hey, it was January 2nd. I was in the Atlantic Ocean.
Yep.
That's what they do, and I know it because I found that most of my friends in Indiana longed to vacation in Florida.
Oh, yeah. You become very popular.
Yeah.
Once you move down here, it's like, hey, I'd drop by and visit you.
Yeah. And then I moved down here, and I find that all my friends in Florida dream about vacationing in North Carolina.
Oh, yeah. That's where my mom lives.
There you go.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Because the mountains are what, you know, people from Florida, they long to see. My guest today is John Heaver. I don't know how we got talking about mountains in Florida, but I'm glad you're here, man. Tell us, before we take a break, tell us a little bit about the church and the name H2O.
Yeah. H2O, the name is drawn from John 4, where Jesus encounters the Samaritan woman. And he described eternal. So he's talking to this unchurched woman. And she might be the least likely candidate mm-hmm. for salvation. And he relates to her on her level and describes eternal life as a drink of water. And so when I read that, it's like, that's us. That's me. I want to reach out to spiritually curious people. So that's where the name came from. So
I saw that on your website.
Yeah.
Spiritually curious. Tell us about that.
I think that there's a lot of, I think my observation of Christians is that about a year after we come to know the Lord, we lose all of our non-Christian friends. And then we have no idea how to relate to people outside of the faith.
Mm-hmm.
And which is sad and unfortunate because many people like me, I was spiritually curious, and some people befriended me, and they seemed authentic to me, and so my own story of coming to know the Lord really helped me to have that heart and vision. So we try to reach out to people through bringing them into a setting where they will feel comfortable. A lot of people, when they first come into a church, have feelings of awkwardness and shame that, like, they're in the presence of God now, mm-hmm. and it's really hard for them. So we try to create a neutral ground where they will feel safe, and we talk to them about Jesus then.
We're going to pick this up in a moment. We got to take a break. We're up against one right now. My guest today is John Heaver. He is the pastor at H2O Church, and he's also an author. We're going to be talking about his book that's coming out real soon. Don't go away. This is Afternoons with Mike, and you're on The Shepherd. My guest in the studio is John Heaver, a pastor at H2O Church. John has been telling us about his background, spent some time in Muncie, Indiana. And I was thinking of Bloomington earlier, I believe. I tell you, my geography in central Indiana, of all of the things, John, when I lived in Indiana, I did not travel but a couple of times to Indianapolis in central Indiana. Now, we did have friends and relatives that lived all the way up near Chicago, and we would take that trip up Highway 41. Mm. Have you ever been on 41?
No, I hate cold. So I would never go to the Windy City.
Yeah, move on up there. Well, our relatives lived just south of Chicago, still in Indiana, up around Schererville, Indiana, for people who know where that is. Probably nobody does, but it's up south of the Chicago area. And there was this one trip, and it was not, one route to there, and it was 41. Well, 41 is a U.S. highway, not an interstate. Now, we think in Florida, people think when you go on a long road trip, you look for the nearest interstate. Well, back in those days, there was no interstate. So we take up 41. And when they took 41 through Evansville, they refused to take a spur around the city. They didn't want a spur around the city to bypass, if you will, Evansville. So they took 41, which was the only north-south route, and they took it through the entire city, and they called it Stoplight City because of that.
Oh, my goodness.
Because the truckers absolutely hated it. Yeah. Could make no time at all coming through Evansville.
I used to live in a neighborhood that had 13 stop signs before you got to our house.
Yeah.
And so we'd invite a friend over and say, oh, it's 20 minutes. And they're like, it took us 40 minutes.
So imagine being the truck driver of an 18-wheeler and having to stop every couple of minutes.
That would not be fun.
Not fun at all. And they didn't like it. So that was there's my Indiana stuff for the day there. Now we're ready to move on. John's down in Florida now. And we're talking about the church and the church name and how you came up with H2O and the drink of water, and that changed all of that. You know, tell us a little bit more about your church here.
Yeah. Do you mind if I tell you a story about it?
No, tell us.
Okay, because this, I think especially during this time of COVID, a lot of people, like you and I were talking earlier, might feel ghosted. And this story, it just shows that that's not true. So 4 years ago, a 70-year-old man walked into our service, totally unchurched. 6 months later, he came to know the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Then he brought around his friend who we began to meet with. My son and I got to meet with him and start to talk about Jesus. He sent me a text one day and said, can you come over to my office, bring your Bible, I have something to share with you. So we show up and he begins to give really a teaching out of Genesis 22 about the offering of Isaac. And at the end, so he was all flushed and nervous, and at the end of sharing with us, he looked me in the eye and he said, I have hated God my whole life.
Mm.
Because what kind of a father, what kind of a God the Father would ask another father, Abraham, to sacrifice his son? But now I get it, that this is a foreshadowing Jesus. And so he became a believer. So 2 years went by, and then both of these men who were unchurched and came to know Jesus sent me a text and said, meet me at this location. So it was 2113 East South Street, and that's where our church is. So I pulled up into the parking lot, and they said, we give you this church. We purchased it, and we give you this $1.5 million building.
No way.
There's another piece coming.
You've caused a couple of accidents with pastors driving right now.
Yeah, yeah.
And hearing this, wait, what? What?
Yeah. Why him? Why not me? Exactly.
That's crazy.
I thought the same thing.
Oh, my goodness.
So the crazy part of the story is still to come. So my mom came to visit, and I said, I want to show you the church that we were given. And about a block away, she said, you know, your grandmother used to live right here, and she used to go to church somewhere right around here. I said, Mom, that's got to be the church that was just given to me. And so we didn't know how to confirm that. And so about 2 weeks later, we were doing a church work day. And this church actually has a basement, which is crazy.
In Florida?
For Florida. It has a basement.
Wow.
And there were some membership photo albums in the basement. And I was pulling them out, and the thought crossed my mind, what if I found my grandmother in here? What would that mean? And on the second page, there she was. And so I was given a church by two men who came to know the Lord later in life. And there are 380,000 churches in America. And the one church that was given to me is where my grandmother used to live.
That is bizarre. Well,
and then I remembered, I visited her about a year after I became a Christian, and I went to church with her.
And you didn't even realize it was that building.
It was the same building.
Oh, my goodness.
So about 3 more months went by, And I began to think about the statistics of it. What are the odds? And I did some analysis and I shared that with some engineering friends, and I had five people confirm this. So if my wife and I both independently picked one star in the Milky Way galaxy and we picked the same star, that would be 20 times more likely than me being given a church that my grandmother used to go to through two men coming to know Jesus later in life. It's a great story, right?
No, it's a great story, and I'm not going to challenge you on that mathematical part of that, because that is, you just lost me on that. The stars in the Milky Way, boy, that's amazing. Boy, what a great, just a realization. I'm still stunned that you were given a $1 million building, and that is in itself just, that just had to be like, okay, I think I'm in God's will now, that I'm here in Orlando, and there's the building that God's given us to meet and to have a church in.
I think that there was a very strong communication from God to me, but I would say that a lot of times we go through hardship. A lot of times we encounter pain and suffering, and you don't see the evidence of God. It's like, where is God? Why is he not showing up in a more powerful way in my life? And it's during those times that we need to know God hasn't ghosted us. Mm-hmm. He is still at work. I just can't see it. That's been really helpful for me to look back on, because the hardships that I've gone through, the things that I've needed to suffer through, God was with me every bit as much as when he gave me this building.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an important thing to remember, especially now during this COVID time.
Mm. Now, you've spent some of your time in this COVID time writing and finishing a book, and that book has a theme about delight and about fatherhood.
Yeah.
Kind of give us the background to that.
Yeah, the background of it is that my dad was not an affectionate man. He was brought up, his dad deserted him when he was 7. So my dad did not know how to be a dad. And so I was brought up in a home where there wasn't a lot of affection, and that affected me. That created a wound in me where I was driven to succeed. I was driven to kind of be somebody. And that's part of my story of coming to know Jesus. So years into my journey, my image of God really still lacked the passion and the depth of love, the delight that a father can have for his son or daughter. And I began to realize that many Christians struggle with this, especially if you've been brought up in a shame-based church, or you struggle a lot with guilt. Sometimes our image of God doesn't reveal the great joy and delight of the Father. This is what we have a hard time with. And so when I heard the prodigal son story, things began to open up in my mind where I realized this is Jesus's revelation of God the Father. And it's about a father who runs out of sheer delight toward his child who has thrown him away, essentially, said, I want
and
what
his
you
inheritance.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And for that to be the revelation of what the heart of God is like has been explosive in my life. It's just transformed my understanding of who he is. And it's helped heal me of performance and drivenness and shame and guilt, and has enabled me to feel that God enjoys me. And so that's a big part of the book.
You know, the concept that you're describing, I mean, I think of the book, The Prodigal God, that was written a couple of years ago, and it really focuses on not the son that was the prodigal, but on the one that was faithful to the father.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we get lost in that story, and we see ourselves being more like the prodigal when we're much more like the other son, who's bitter and angry that his dad would be so excited and so open and so forgiving.
Yeah.
It really is hard. And you said something a little bit earlier about a guilt-based church or something like that, or a guilt-based experience in church.
Yeah.
People you feel are often attending church services, but that's kind of like what's left behind, almost like a bad taste in the mouth.
Yeah. Yeah. what we bring to the table in salvation is nothing but our sin. And so if that's our beginning point, I wish that we could just stay there, because when a person becomes a believer, especially if they're from an unchurched background like me, we experience God's love. And it's like, I've done nothing for God, but I'm convinced he loves me. 2 years into our journey after that, people begin to feel like, I don't know, am I disappointing God? Am I doing enough? And that sense of delight seems to evaporate.
Now, do you cover this in the book?
I do.
Oh, well, this is really good. I think I've heard it maybe expressed even differently, but the same concept about how that people begin to lose their vision, lose the fire. And probably the reason they do is they've lost the relationship.
Yeah.
You know, lost the joy of the Lord. Because I think that everybody, when they first come to the Lord in salvation, they would have the sense that my sins are forgiven and that I'm different. I don't think they come in like, well, I'm here because I'm just so excited that I'm going to get to live under guilt for the next 20 years. You know, that never happens. You said no one, you know. But the point of it is that something or some force has stepped in and really messed us up.
Yeah. Yeah, big time. And that's a big part of the book, too, is that we battle against lies. A lot of us have haunting lies, like I'm not enough. God isn't pleased with me. And these kind of sit in the subtext of our lives, and they affect us, and they control how we navigate life. And we may not even be aware that that is planted in our heart, and that I need to discern that and see God the Father as someone who delights in us.
Tell us the title of the book.
It's called The Hidden Delight of God, How to Kill Your Fear, Find Your Freedom, and Take Back Your Life.
Okay, let's take that. There's a 3-point message right there.
Yeah.
And you're probably going to preach that when the book comes out. Maybe you've already done it. But let's take those 3 points. How does the book address number one?
Yeah. So the hidden delight. Can I just do the title first?
And yeah, then absolutely. Okay, so we'll make it a 4-point.
Yeah, okay. So the hidden delight of God is that God the Father delights in us. And that's evident even in the Exodus story. Moses, I think it's Deuteronomy 32, he says that you are the apple of God's eye. And yet, as you watch the story unfold, Moses describes God as a father who carries a son. The people of Israel, instead of having that sonship identity, live from an orphan identity. Mm-hmm. They feel like God has ghosted them, and they say things like, why is God trying to kill us? They say things like to Moses, why did you bring us out of Egypt?
Mm-hmm.
And it is because the delight of God has been hidden from their eyes.
Hmm.
And which, if you think about it, makes a lot of sense, because almost everybody of the people of Israel was born a slave, they lived as a slave, and they died as a slave. So the narrative that they were in was that God wanted to save the world through the descendants of Abraham, that God had his eyes on everybody, and he chose a group of people that he delighted in to save them and through them bring the Messiah and save the world. That was the narrative. That was the narrative that they had been told, Genesis 12, that was passed on from generation to generation. But the narrative that they told themselves was that we have been forgotten, which, of course, you're a slave. How could you think anything but that? And so as the story goes on, that makes sense that they would say those crazy things, that why is God trying to kill us? He saved you. Why would you say that? And it's because of that haunting lie in their heart. The false narrative that they're living in.
You know, it's not helped by the fact that our human nature, and you think about the story of Moses and the Pharaoh's plagues and all of the things that went on, those 10 plagues that really you would think at any one of them. I mean, we've always laughed about the one, heard a guy preach a message one time, another night with the frogs, because, you know, he said, well, I'll think about it overnight. So let's live with the frogs. Just in my bed and oh my goodness, I can't imagine what a scene that was. But you would think that any one of those plagues would have settled the question that God is God.
Yeah. You would think that, but I think that our beliefs are very deeply rooted.
Yeah.
And they had believed in these gods all of their lives. And so as you read the story, it becomes evident that there is a process that they need to go through. They've been praying to Sekhmet, and then one of the plagues happens, and that god is shot down. So that would affect your prayer life. Mm-hmm. It's like, I'm not praying to Sekhmet anymore. And then as time goes by, some of them begin to fear the Lord. Some of them begin to revere Moses. And when they walk out of Egypt, it says a mixed multitude went with them.
Yeah.
And so God decimated the land of Egypt so that he could save some of the people of Egypt. But mm-hmm. It was a process, and it took time.
Well, it's a fascinating study to hear you say all of this. And the name of the book, again, it's not out yet.
September 28th.
September 28th. We're almost to release date.
The Hidden Delight of God. And chapter one of that book is on my website if you subscribe there, which is howtoliveunleashed.com. So if you subscribe there, you get chapter one, and you can then decide whether or not you want to read the book.
Mm-hmm. Now, will the book be available there as well?
Yeah. Yes, it will.
And what about on Amazon and all the rest of the sellers? Okay.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And when we come back from break, I want you to tell the story about the publishing of the book, because this is a day and age where all of that changed a couple of years ago with the advent of the Amazon readers and Kindle and all of that. But you've written a real book. It's going to be a real book with like pages. Imagine that. All right. My guest today is John Heaver from H2O Church. Don't go away. We'll be right back. This is Afternoons with Mike. My guest in the studio is John Heaver. John is with H2O Church. John talked about point one out of four on his book, and that was the title. And now we're here to this point about killing fear. How does the book help one kill fear?
Yeah. So there is a part of the Exodus story that many of us know, and that is that this is a metaphor of the Christian journey. That just as the people were enslaved and then they were delivered and then they passed through the Red Sea and walked through a wilderness to a promised land, that's the Christian journey too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the story that a lot of people know. What a lot of people do not know is that Moses' identity had been stolen from him. And so when he met God at the burning bush, he was a mess. So the text is subtle, but it's there. It is really there. So Acts 7 says that Moses understood himself to be the deliverer of Israel before his 40 years of exile in Midian. So he attempted to deliver, and he failed.
Mm-hmm. Killing the Egyptian and all of that.
Exactly.
And then running.
And then it had to kill who he really was, too. Mm-hmm. It also says that he was mighty in his words. Now, let that sink in for a minute, because when God shows up at the burning bush and reveals himself, Moses' mantra is,
I can't speak. I can't speak. Yeah.
So something has devastated him.
It's a good point.
So imagine, because I've experienced this, you feel like you have a calling from God, and God doesn't show up. Like, he sacrificed. He left the palace. He expected God to show up in his life, and he didn't. And then 40 years goes by.
Mm-hmm.
He gets married, has a child, names the child Gershom, which means a stranger there or alien, which is what he felt. I am now in Midian. I'm a stranger here. I'm an alien. So let that sink in. He commemorates the naming of his son with the most painful event of his life.
God, it's amazing.
And so then when the burning bush happens and God calls him, he doesn't just struggle. He is unwilling. At the end of this dialogue with God, he says, please send somebody else. And so Moses, the guy that used to be mighty in his words, mm-hmm. is afraid to stand up in front of Pharaoh. So Aaron, his brother, is the one that does all the speaking through plagues 1, 2, and 3.
Mm-hmm.
And then in plague 4, Moses is instructed by God to take center stage, and he begins to talk. And then talks some more, and then he's the only one talking.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you think about that, that's where that's one piece of the killing your fear, is that he is directed by God to go back to the place of his wounding, back to Egypt, to face the world's greatest power at that time, and to stand on a stage and to be bold and fearless. And it's a process. He doesn't get there immediately, but the instruction is, you've got to kill your fear.
Yeah. And as a simultaneous thing happens when you embrace God's plan in your life.
Yeah.
And the killing of fear.
Yeah.
It happens simultaneously.
Yeah, I agree.
Now, not to say you won't ever have fear.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we do. It comes back. But I'm just saying that if we keep our eyes on the Lord,
yes,
then we can do what he did and pick up the mantle of speaking,
yeah,
and do what God told us to do.
I think the danger, though, is that when I think that Christianity does not focus on the heart enough. We don't look at what is actually going on in our feelings enough. And what that does is it creates a dissonance between our theological beliefs and our true heart behavior. And so what I call that in the book is the orphan identity.
Mm.
I say that God is great. I say that God is holy. He's mighty. He's sovereign. But how do I pray? How am I taking risks for God? Am I killing my fear? Or am I stuck just being an attender, not really showing up in my own life? And that's the orphan identity. And mm-hmm. that dissonance is created by ignoring the heart. And we see that in the story.
Mm. It's a great analogy between the way we can live.
Yeah.
Are you a son or are you an orphan?
Well, I'm just speaking out of my own life.
Yeah.
I believe I've known the Lord now for 40 years. And I think this really took root in my life about 2 years ago. And let that sink in. You can get way down the road.
Mm-hmm.
I've been a pastor for a long time. I've pastored other pastors. I've spoken at conferences. And there were issues of shame still in my heart. And there were issues where I really struggled to believe that God could delight in me.
Mm-mm-mm.
So I said I was a son, but I think to some degree I lived like an orphan.
You know, I think there's a lot of truth to be said about the difference in what we declare,
yes,
and what we functionally do. That's something that I learned in taking kind of classes for counseling, is that people, they'll declare what they believe, but then they live in a different way. And we have to uncover, what is that functional belief?
Yeah,
It's the declared belief that's out there, but the functional belief is what's in there.
I didn't know you had taken counseling courses. That's an important thing, because we really need to understand what is going on in our hearts. And like a great example of that is prayer. Almost every Christian I know really struggles with prayer. And if you compare our prayer life to our theological beliefs, it becomes very evident. Again, I believe that God, let me put it this way. It's easy to say that God is transcendent, that he's up there, that he's on the throne, he's in control. It's another thing to say that God is imminent, that God is engaging me mm-hmm. in my life, mm-hmm. that he is intimately involved with the details of my life. And so there's no risk saying that God is transcendent. There's great risk at saying God is imminent, because now God might just disappoint me. If I can't see God moving in my life, it creates a dissonance, and it's like, I don't know. And so I think what we end up doing is we believe great things about God. It's like saying, I believe God is holy, God is big, he is infinite, he loves me. We just don't talk much.
Hmm.
And that's been the main, maybe the main area where my faith has grown, my prayer life has grown dramatically as I've thought about God delighting in me. And there's so many scriptures that talk about God's delight. But it seems like they're hidden from our eyes, mm-hmm. like Zephaniah 3:17.
I knew you were going to say that. Yeah, he sings over you.
Yeah, he sings over
us. Yeah.
Psalm 32, David says, you are my hiding place. You surround me with shouts of deliverance. Now imagine some, like, here's what I describe it as in my writing, is that imagine you do a piano solo as a little kid, and you totally wreck it. It's horrible. And there in the audience is your dad, and no one claps. It's so awkward because you were so bad, and your dad stands up and just shouts, and he's so proud of you and so excited. And so if that's the way God is, if he actually does rejoice over us, then prayer changes. It's like, mm-hmm. my Father wants to be with me and I want to be with him.
It's a beautiful thought. That's number two, the middle one, middle phrase of your book.
Yes. And then to take back your life, his life had been stolen from him. So John 10:10 says the thief comes only to steal, kill, and destroy.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I can speak for everybody on that, but I think that sometimes we think that Satan's activity in our lives is only with like some great temptation. So my question is, what does it look like to have your sense of calling, your sense of dignity, your self-worth stolen, killed, or destroyed? What does it look like? So 1 Peter 5 describes Satan as a roaring lion. One of the things I say in the book is that you in between those lion's jaws? And my point is, we need to have clarity about what it looks like to have our understanding of God taken away from us. And what does it look like to live as if we are orphans? And mm-hmm. once I began down that track, I realized I need to fight for my life. I need to fight for my heart. I need to dig out some haunting lies, some false beliefs that are in my faith. I need to take back my life here. And then this kind of happened as an accident because I had already written the book, already had the title, The Hidden Delight of God, and had a different subtitle. I don't even remember what it was. And as I began to think about the subtitle, I looked again at Moses' life and realized that's what he's doing. As he kills his fear and he finds his freedom, he's emerging into who he knew he was all along. Mm-hmm. He becomes this great, courageous leader who's really amazing. That's who he was meant to be. But so many things were stolen from him. So that's what that third part is about.
You know what I love about your book and the subtitle and all of that is that it is almost like it's written for such a time as this, when we are living right now in a time where really all of those things are being talked about, fear, freedom, and who we are. You know, I think America in some ways, to kind of draw it out of a believer's life and into just our nation, we've lost ourselves.
Yeah.
I'm not sure we know who we are anymore.
Right. And identity is meant to fuel our lives. That's why there's so much written about it by Paul in the New Testament. There's so much where it says, this is who you are. You're the light of the earth. You're the light of the world, salt of the earth. Mm-hmm. You're the temple of the Holy Spirit. All of these things are metaphor to explode our minds, to think, gosh, I'm the temple of the Holy Spirit. What does that mean? What does that look like? And there's such powerful illustrations, but I think our temptation is to live small. And I say that because I've lived small. And so now as God is teaching me this, I'm learning to step out boldly and to not let fear control me. I'm a child of the King, and I want to live like a child of the King, and I want to engage every moment in life as if God, and this is strange to say, I want to experience every moment in life as if God is for me.
Mm-hmm.
And we theologically believe that, but again, I think that we often don't live that way.
I think you're right. And I think if we were to live not only believing that he is for us, but that he is, in your words earlier, he's imminent.
Yeah.
He's here now. And I'm convinced that if we lived every day of our lives and throughout the entire day of our life, let's speak just about today, with a sense that he is literally right next to us.
Yeah.
Literally, if we were able to tangibly sense his being right next to us, it would change what we do.
Absolutely. My wife went through a very, very long bout of severe depression, really needed to fight her way out of it and did. And during that time, I discovered the Psalms and I began to see how intimate God was toward David. And David said, he's at my right hand. He's holding my hand. He rescued me because he delighted in me. All of these things, it's like, I'm going to start praying these things. I'm going to start talking to
really
God
good.
The way David talks to God, because that's true. Am I the apple of God's eye? Well, I believe that now.
I believe it. And I think your book is going to really speak to a lot of hearts. And just even hearing you talk about it, Yeah, it sounds like an incredibly well-written book and a very timely one as well, because people need this, man. People need right now hope. And I believe our country is in dire shortage of it. And we need people who are going to stand up and say, hey, here's the real source.
Yeah.
I heard David Jeremiah say this. He said, people are always saying, all I'm left with is prayer. Mm. And he said, well, if that's true, then what you've been reduced to is only having the greatest power in the entire universe. I mean, that's how big God is.
Amen.
He's able to do it. Amen. And, you know, I'd love to hear more about it. You've got to come back when your book is out.
I'd love to.
I'd love to have you come back up because I think there's another whole story about how this book is being published that we never got to today. Yeah. And I would love to have you back, John.
I'd love to do that.
Yeah, this is great. I've enjoyed talking with you and even being able to talk about things, the theological aspect of our lives together, because we've only touched on these things, man. I mean, there's a lot there, a lot of digging to do. John Heaver from H2O Church, thanks for coming by today, and we'll see you next time when you're here. And friends, we thank you for joining us on the program. That's Afternoons with Mike, and we'll catch you next time right here on The Shepherd.